I was never really interested in this idea of like, you know, defining myself by genre. It's very vague for those of us who know a little bit about, you know, jazz or a little bit about classical or a little bit about Indian classical. It's like these, you know, there's so many, you know, styles. So I was always interested in, you know, kind of, you know, finding the commonalities, you know, between traditions and respecting the differences, but trying to understand, you know.
Herzlich willkommen zu Weites Feld, dem Podcast für klassische Musiker auf der Suche nach Inspiration und neuen Wegen. Mein Name ist Max Gärtner und ich treffe mich mit Musikschaffenden, die mit einer klassischen Ausbildung begonnen haben und unkonventionelle Wege gegangen sind, um ihre ganz eigene Idee einer Karriere im Musikbusiness zu leben. Gemeinsam versuchen wir herauszufinden, worauf es bei einer Karriere als Profimusiker ankommt, wie man als Freelancer die richtige Work-Life-Balance findet und sich selbst dabei immer treu bleibt. Hallo, herzlich willkommen zur neuen Folge von Weites Feld, der Podcast. Nach einem langen Tag vollgepackt mit Workshops und Konzerten hat sich der Percussionist Rohan Krishnamurti noch die Zeit genommen, um hier zu später Stunde ein Interview für meinen Podcast zu geben. Wir haben über den Unterschied von klassischer und klassischer indischer Musik gesprochen. Ich habe eine Menge darüber gelernt, wie intensiv das Verhältnis zwischen Lehrer und Schüler in Indien sein kann und dass Studenten teilweise über mehrere Jahre hinweg bei ihrem Lehrer zu Hause wohnen und da so ein richtiger Teil der Familie sind. Rohan tourt international, hat ein PhD in Musikwissenschaft abgelegt. Er hat seine eigene Musikschule gegründet und hat bereits für namhafte Filmproduktionen im Studio gearbeitet. Ich bin jedenfalls super happy, dass Rohan sich so spontan die Zeit genommen hat, zu später Stunde noch das Interview zu führen und wünsche euch jetzt erstmal viel Spaß beim Zuhören. So welcome, Rohan. I appreciate very much that you take the time after your performance to have a short talk with me. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Max. You know, great to be here.
I read on your schedule that you have been to Pop Academy in Mannheim some days ago. Mm-hmm. I saw on the website that Hindol Depp is teaching there, with whom recently I had a performance with in the Alte Oper at Frankfurt. And it's like In the last years, it's developing like most of universities or music high schools are exploring the field of the world music studies. Mm-hmm. So people that may be studying pop music or something like that have the chance to do something with world music instruments, Indian music, of course, and that's a very interesting way to expand the vocabulary of music and also rhythmical things, as
sure,
we learned tonight, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And my thinking was, how is it in India? You know, is it like the people start at a very young age with the Indian traditional music, or how is it to get a music education?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a big topic, and I can, you know, I guess share some points from my own experiences. I can't speak about everyone and everything, but just some things I've kind of observed. And you know, I guess it really depends. I mean, some people are lucky to have, you know, musical exposure from a young age at home, whether, you know, their parents, their family's in music, or they have the opportunity to go to concerts, performances of different kinds, or even just, you know, having a collection of music, you know, tapes, CDs, you know, records, Spotify, whatever. Everyone obviously doesn't have that. Some people are privileged to have that kind of exposure. And again, it just depends on your community. Who are your friends? You know, what do they do? You know, what's in the vicinity of your home and your neighborhood? So I think it really varies a lot depending on where you are, you know, in India. And I think there's some schools that have, you know, music programs and many that don't. So I think it varies a lot, just like in the United States, where I grew up. There are certain schools, you know, certain school districts that have excellent music programs and orchestras and, you know, jazz bands and choirs. And then there are other school districts that don't have anything. And oftentimes the first time that's first thing to be cut are, you know, the music and arts programs. So I think it varies a lot. And of course, there are many different kinds of music, right? Indian classical music itself, there are two major traditions, the North Indian classical or Hindustani music, the South Indian classical or Carnatic music, the Carnatic ones that I specialize in. So again, depending on where you are in India, you might have more exposure to one kind of music than the other. But then, of course, there's so many forms of, you know, popular music and Bollywood and, you know, film music. And there's, for a long time now, there's been plenty of exposure to different forms of Western, you know, music, American pop music, or, you know, different types of, you know, electronic music, and there are festivals for jazz and different types of things. So, you know, again, depending on where you are, you could be hearing all sorts of music, you know, by, you know, local and international artists, and, you know, have a very rich kind of musical environment, or you could be in a place where you don't have any of that. So I guess, you know, it really just depends on where you are.
And you grew up in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And we had a short chat before during lunch, and maybe you can tell something about, is it really true that you started studying the classical Indian music via a phone?
Yeah. I mean, that definitely happened. I grew up, so I was born in L.A., Los Angeles, but I grew up mostly in Michigan, in a very small town in southwest Michigan called Kalamazoo. My whole family is into music, and my parents were born and grew up in India, and had a lot of exposure to music. My mom learned Indian classical singing in Calcutta and Northeast India. And they had a huge collection of Indian music tapes. They'd collected tapes, you know, back then, for over many, many years, and very, like, neatly cataloged. You know, who are the artists? What are the pieces? You know, the ragas, the thalas, all these things. So I was lucky to have that, you know, growing up. And all of our road trips, you know, they'd put in a concert. You know, we go for a 3-hour drive, 3-hour concert. You know, so you get a lot of exposure. But I grew up in this small town, and the small town had, and even now doesn't really have an Indian music scene. But in the sort of mid to late 90s, there were a few individuals in the community who did have that training. There's a university in Kalamazoo, and that, you know, attracted students from, you know, from abroad, including India. And my first teacher, Damodaran Srinivasan, he was a graduate student, a master's student at the university, and he was there for a couple of years. And yeah, I mean, there was a whole variety of reasons, you know, why I said I want to start learning the mridangam, the, you know, Indian percussion. But we happened to have an instrument at home, and again, I had a lot of this exposure. But we also happened to have a teacher in town, and he happened to be a really wonderful teacher and a really wonderful person. So I first started learning from him. For about, I think, maybe 2 months, and he taught me a lot of the fundamental techniques and the vocal percussion, the syllables, and all that stuff. But then, I think after 2 months, he graduated and moved. He, you know, moved to Boston, Massachusetts, you know, several hundred miles away, and there were no other, you know, Indian percussion teachers within like 3-4 hours of Kalamazoo. You'd have to go to Detroit or Chicago, you know, and even there, there were no professional, full-time, you know, musicians and teachers in Indian music. So my teacher, you know, Damodaran Srinivasan, he said, you know, okay, why don't we try the speakerphone technology? You know, this is pre-Skype, pre-FaceTime, you know.
So that's the first generation online lessons.
Online, yes. Long-distance education, right? So we had, like, literally a speaker that was attached to our phone, and, you know, and he would do these lessons, and he would recite all the material, all the repertoire, and he would play it, and then he'd ask me to, you know, to recite and play it back. And I was, you know, I was a kid at the time. I was, what, 8 years old, 9, and I didn't really know what was going on. I was like, okay, you know, I took some lessons with him in person, and awesome, and now I'm doing this thing over the speakerphone. Okay, it's a little different, but, you know, the beauty of this, you know, tradition is that, you know, when you say, you know, like, you say that, And once you know the syllables and the movements, you can translate that, you know, to your hands and to your instrument. So I was able to do that. And you know, because of that vocal percussion, I was able to, you know, learn a lot of material for about a year over the speakerphone. And it was after that that I met my advanced teacher, Kuruvaya Dorai, who's a master, a legend in the field. He's almost 85 now, based in India. My lessons with him were in person, so he didn't teach over the phone or Skype or anything like that. Those were in person, mostly in India, and also when he'd come to the U.S. for tours.
So just for those who might not know it, maybe we shortly say something about why it was possible to get taught via the phone, because the Indian music, as we heard also tonight in your concert, is mainly based on rhythmical vocabulary, right?
Right.
Maybe you can tell short things about how, if you listen to this vocabulary, as you told also in your today's workshop here, how you can easily translate it to a drum, so it's no problem if you only hear it via phone and you have also an imagination how it sounds in the drum.
Absolutely, yeah. So again, you know, you have these syllables. Every stroke has a name. So you can develop these words and phrases, sentences using this language. It's called a konakol or solkata. And it's a drum language. So like I said, you say a phrase, you know, tanga dinat dom. Like you say that, and then you can translate that to movements, you know, once you know the strokes. So yeah, so in that sense, the tradition does lend itself quite a bit to this kind of, you know, long distance education. Now, of course, nowadays, you know, most people that are doing this are using something like Skype or FaceTime. I mean, the visual thing is is obviously nice to have. But at the time, there was really no option. And yeah, so you kind of learn these, you know, different phrases and you always start by reciting before even touching your instrument. You clap out the beat, you know, and you say all the repertoire, and just like we did today in the workshop. And you know, and then as you learn the material vocally, then you can translate it to your instrument. I have to say though that, you know, the tradition in the past and even largely now, it's an oral tradition, meaning, you know, there's no notation traditionally. It's, you know, passed from, you know, a master to apprentice, you know, guru to shishya through oral, you know, means. You recite, you play, you observe. And, but, you know, in the last, you know, couple of generations, people have experimented with notation of different kinds. So, and I myself have different ways of notating the music. So when you have the notation, as we use, you know, today in the workshop, and the reciting and, say, recordings, then it can be, you know, effective and an efficient way to learn the material.
Great. Talking about the master that teaches something to his students, right? You had then a teacher that you had live lessons with in India.
Yeah.
And how is this special relationship between, you know, master and student? It seems to be very, very, very private, right?
Yeah, it's. I mean, again, it's a very special relationship, you know, where the master is not just, you know, even limited to being a teacher. I mean, again, historically, traditionally, the master is, you know, is a life guide, a spiritual guide. You know, you're learning music, but you're also learning, you know, how to interact with other musicians, how to, you know, how to live a good life, you know, a balanced life. You know, you're learning all these, you know, details of being, you know, an artist and being a human being. So typically students learn from one private teacher for an extended period of time. Unlike, you know, some of the conservatory models where you might take a couple of lessons from this person or a couple of lessons from that person. You typically, you know, in the Indian classical tradition, you study with one person for an extended period of time. You learn their style, you learn that lineage. You know, it's not just a matter of, you know, learning that person's art. It's like, what did their teacher do? You know, what kind of style did they have? What were the artistic, the aesthetic, the social, the cultural issues they were dealing with, you know, 50 years ago? And then what about their teacher? And so it's this kind of lineage, this tradition. And you then become the next generation of that. So, you know, again, I said my advanced teacher is 85 years old. He represents, you know, Gurvaya Dorai, sir, he represents something from really a historic era. He was active like during the post-independence era in India, when artists were just slowly starting to tour internationally to America, to Europe. He did a very, you know, landmark performance at Carnegie Hall back in, I believe, the 70s, you know, with M.S. Subbulakshmi, this great singer. So it's, you know, I learned the music, the style from him, but also what was he, you know, dealing with? And it's easy to focus on ourselves, right? You know, life's tough and career's hard. And, you know, as a freelancer, you know, what do you do? What's next? But then this kind of gives you a perspective. It's like, wow, you know, when my teacher was whatever, 30 years old, like these were the things he was dealing with, you know? And you go back like whatever, one more generation or two, and they were dealing with an era of like royal patronage, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that's how much things have changed. And each generation has had to adapt and, you know, come up, innovate and come up with new ways of, you know, making their skills relevant to mm-hmm. their world.
So it's a very personal relationship with the teacher, and it has a lot to do with some kind of responsibility for your students' life, right?
Yeah. Again, if you look back, you know, historically, students would often live with their teachers.
Really?
So it's not even a matter
of... In their house of their teacher.
And, you know, it's not a matter of going for an hourly lesson once a week mm-hmm. kind of thing. Like, you live there, and you are part of the family, and you're running errands, and you're, you know, helping the teacher and the family do these things, and you go to every concert with the teacher. You help them prepare their instruments, you mm-hmm. know. You see, you observe, you know, how do they interact with other artists? How do they manage all these different, you know, things going on?
So, and how do they live their life, even the personal, private life, right?
Exactly, okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, I've heard so many stories about, you know, artists. They talk about not just, okay, what did, the master play in the concert, but how did they get ready for the performance? That's an art. You know, how do you prepare your instruments? How do you, you know, prepare your outfit? How do you, you know, get into that mindset? You know, and so there's a lot. That tradition of living, you know, with your teacher, it's what's called a Gurukula Vasa, that's not so common anymore. And that's something that's changed in a matter of, I think, a couple of generations. It's just because of modern life, a lot of artists are living in cities, you know, there's the dynamics of, you know, of the industry have changed so much.
That was what I was thinking when you told about this, because it seems to me it has a lot to do with sitting and watching and, you know, being right. something like very patient right. and watch what the teacher does all the day, something like right. that seems very like an opposite from today's life. Everything is so fast. Right. Everyone wants to not read a book, but get right. a, you know, 50-minute video of it and know right. everything. And yeah,
right. I think, yeah, absolutely. It's a different thing. I mean, I think it's one thing to learn the music, you know, the notes, the rests, you know, how fast you play it, you know, what does it sound like? That's one thing. So it's one thing to learn the music. It's another thing to be a musician. Right. So, you know, just playing, just, you know, doing your thing on your instrument, that's a very specific skill. But, you know, what does it mean to be a musician as a whole? What kind of life is that? What kind of, you know, interaction do you have with your family, with your friends, with your colleagues? Like, that's a different thing. And although, you know, we may not be living with our teachers anymore, I think through the course of our careers, for those of us who are full time and serious, like, we're still spending a lot of time observing those things, you know. I mean, so many of my lessons, you know, with my teacher, it was, you know, not, you know, okay, 11 a.m. to noon, you come for the lesson and you leave at noon. I mean, you come early, you know, you observe what's going on, you know. I went to a lot of concerts with my teacher. I also was very lucky to play with my teacher in like double mridangam, double percussion concerts with him mm-hmm. in the U.S. and India. And that's a different experience. And you know, and there's a lot more than just, you know, the lesson, in a sense. But again, you know, things are changing and people are busy, you know. And back in the day, again, you know, we're talking about a different social situation where if you wanted to be a musician, for example, you might drop out of school, you know. You might drop out of, you know, whatever, sixth grade, and say, okay, I want to be a musician. This is what I got to do. 100% of my time is, you know, living with my teacher, you know, attending to his, you know, his or her needs, and, you know, practicing, you know, doing all that stuff. Not, you know, getting a college degree or, you know, or a doctorate or something. It was a different social context.
But by the way, doctorate and being busy, of course, you didn't only study the traditional Indian music, but you also studied some kind of classical percussion. Is that right? And you made a PhD in musicology?
Yeah, that's right. So so it's interesting. I would say my first musical language is Carnatic music, the Indian classical tradition, which is very interesting. And as a second generation Indian American growing up in Kalamazoo, Michigan, you wouldn't expect Indian classical music to be your first musical language, but those were the circumstances I grew up in. I was in many ways very lucky. It was a very unique situation because my family was really into music and we happened to have a teacher in town. It was a very unique kind of, the stars aligned for this to happen. I don't think you could have created this, concocted this. This is just the way it happened. So, but by about high school, I started studying the piano and music theory. In college, I did a major in music, which involved a lot of, obviously, Western music history and theory and ethnomusicology, the study of world music. And we studied a lot of things, American, music, popular music. And then I went on to the Eastman School of Music for my master's and doctorate in musicology and ethnomusicology. So I was lucky to study a lot of different kinds of music. So it was a very, in America, and I think in a lot of, urban centers these days, we're dealing with an incredible diversity of people and cultures and obviously music. So we have access to, to a lot of things these days, whether it's live performances, whether it's recordings, YouTube. I mean, I've met so many students and they're like, I saw this on YouTube, I saw that on YouTube, which is amazing. It's great that you have access to these things. We may or may not know the full context of what we're seeing, but we have some exposure to it. So I was lucky to do that. I studied drum set. And some classical percussion in college, Kalamazoo College, where I went to school, and I continued that at Eastman, and I've been working on a setup, what I call a hybrid kit, which kind of combines the Indian percussion and drum set,
which became a very special thing because you're very well known for combining the traditional Indian music with the modern jazz and funk music.
So that's something it's always been in my mind, and especially as a drummer, as a percussionist, I mean, rhythm always seemed to like a universal language to me. It's like no matter what kind of collaborative setting you're in, it's like the drummers always found a way to bridge things, and that's not to say that other kinds of melody and lyrics can't, but there's rhythm, there's no language barrier. We're not speaking in German, we're not speaking in English, we're speaking in time, and and every tradition anywhere in the world has drums of different kinds. So I was always interested, and I was never really interested in this idea of defining myself by genre, right? The genre is like, we all understand that, we need genres to understand things, but it's like, it's also this boundary that, that is very vague. For those of us who know a little bit about, jazz or a little bit about classical or a little bit about Indian classical, it's like these, there's so many, styles and it's changed over time and every artist has a different approach. So I was always interested in, finding the commonalities, between traditions and respecting the differences, but trying to understand, if I want to collaborate with an orchestra, where are they coming from? Like, what are the norms, the conventions of that? Instead of just throwing things together and just seeing, let's, have a jam session, see what happens. Like, trying to understand, what's this language about? What's the use of notation in this tradition versus that tradition? And I was lucky throughout college to really have that opportunity to work with, orchestras, the great composers, who were also, very supportive of that. So I was, I think, surrounded by a lot of very open-minded, creative people, and that made a lot of the stuff possible. And I'm always, happy to see, you never know where that next, creative collaboration is going to happen. They're I think, open-minded, smart, creative, energetic people everywhere, and it's just a matter of, finding them and finding those connections and creating those connections.
Sounds great. But I mean, that sounds really, really fabulous. It's like studying as an 8-year-old child, and then you study also the classical music, and then you make your PhD in musicology, and then, you know.
Yeah, it's all super easy.
It's like, it's like, okay, and then I combined, you know, it's like pop and funk and the Indian music, and then I work with orchestras, and now I have the pleasure to meet you here on your second European tour, you know. And maybe a few steps earlier, how was, just for the people, you know, that listen to the podcast, how did the professional musician's life start? You know, what was your first step, or were your first steps into the big business, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you pointed that out. I mean, I'm just kind of, you know, looking back and kind of giving you some of the, you know, some of the highlights, but it's all very hard. This is very hard
work. Thank you very much.
This is a very hard work. No one knows what tomorrow is going to be. You know, that's the reality. I mean, so I'm not a pessimist. I'm not going to tell you that, you know, everything's terrible, you know, the industry's crumbling. Like, yes, there are a lot of problems in every field, but I also see a problem as an opportunity, right? It's like, okay, there are issues, but maybe this is an opportunity for us to adapt, to innovate, to change, to connect to new audiences, you know, create new art. Because as we know, no tradition is static. Every generation has been doing, you know, things that, again, to make it relevant to that generation. So, but I think a lot of it, I feel like if I look back, everything can be viewed as like a blessing or a curse. It depends on how you look at it, half full or half empty, right? So I never really thought of myself as a professional musician. You know, I think it's one of those terms that sort of came later on. You know, it's like as an 8-year-old, you know, you're not thinking about, am I going to be a pro? It's like, am I bridging cultures? Am I, you know... You know, how am I going to bridge the, you know, modern jazz and funk with Indian classical? Like, you just kind of do stuff, you know?
You just sit in front of the phone with the speaker
and you don't even really think about that. It's like, you know, you want to learn, you know, it's cool, it's a great instrument, you're having fun. It's like, you know, and then later on, you know, as an adult, you try to make sense of it. But it's like, you know, you hear interesting sounds, you know, whether it's in the radio, on TV, you know, concerts, you hear interesting things, you meet interesting people. And you start kind of putting these things together. And I think I was lucky to start performing, you know, at a pretty young age. And I think by 10, I was like performing Indian classical concerts and, you know, and I had to travel a lot, again, thanks to family support. I mean, these things don't happen automatically. I mean, it takes a lot of family support. My parents were, you know, always ready to be on the road, you know, to go for a show, to even just to take me, let alone for performances, even just to take me to Chicago or Detroit and say, hey, check it out. You know, mm-hmm. This is what a concert's like, check it out. So so because of that family support and everything, I was able to kind of start performing at a young age and all over the country and in India. So, you know, every December I'd go there for performances and during the big music festival in Chennai. And so you kind of do all these things in different ways. It kind of develops and... college or even later, it's like, then people are like, okay, you're playing with professionals. You're playing with, you know, other good artists. So the label kind of comes naturally. You know, I think it's very dangerous if you wake up one day and say, I want to be a professional musician.
Yeah,
like people should treat me like a professional. Like
what
does that mean? And how are, you know, it kind of happens in its own way sometimes. And again, so much of my story is like other people's. Like, this is not something, my story is not something I entirely envisioned, you know, whatever, 20 years ago. Like, every step of the way, you're kind of seeing what's in front of you, and you're like, okay, here's some interesting things, interesting opportunities, you know, interesting people. And you also have a certain vision. Okay, this is cool, but maybe these are some other things I want to do. So how do we kind of balance, you know, this vision for the future with the reality of the present and the reality of the past, you know? You know, you could want to, you know, one day you could wake up and say, I wish I was a professional, you know, football player. But if that's not,
good
you
luck.
Know, if they, yeah, that's not, you know, the reality of your past, then, you know, that may not be something you can do immediately. So it's kind of, you know, balancing all that stuff and realizing, yeah, it's hard work. No one knows what, you know, what's going to happen in the future. Future meaning even like, you know, a week from now. So it's like every day you're meeting people, doing interesting things, you know. Composition itself in a performance is such a spontaneous thing. Right, like the performance that we just had, like I had an idea of what was going to happen. I knew some of the pieces, and you know, obviously, you know, spent a lot of time with Ernst and, you know, and working on some of these tracks. But what actually happened, the way that it happened, the way the audience responded, like so much of that is spontaneous, and now I have new ideas. Like, okay, this is an interesting way we kind of approach this piece. Like, next time, maybe we can do this, you know? So yeah, I think just that idea of being, like, open to adapting, you know, and innovating and negotiating, because it's very hard to do exactly what you want, you know, and it's very hard to, like, predict exactly where you're going to be. So you kind of, again, have to balance that idea of, like, here's a vision of what I can do, what I want to do, with, like, you know, the reality. Where am I? You know, what do I need to work on? And working hard. I mean, I guess there's no shortcut.
Hustle.
You got to hustle. You got to hustle and you got to work hard. There's on everything. It's, you know, not, I think, it's not just one thing, right? There's so many aspects to being a successful artist, a musician. And again, that's true for everyone, though. You know, I think it's there's no shortcuts. You know, I think no matter what you're doing, like you there's certain things come easily, certain things don't. And I think the more and more we avoid the things that don't come easily, like they find a way to come back and prevent us from doing, you know, certain things. So kind of realizing, you know, deal with the hard things too. Don't just do what comes easy, but deal with the discomfort, you know, and work hard at it, and, you know, and be open.
You just mentioned Ernst with its, which is Ernst Ströhr, who is the musician that performed with you on stage tonight. Mm-hmm. He is also, he performed with you, but he is also some kind of your student. Mm-hmm. And so you're a teacher yourself, some kind of master that teaches other students. And you also have your own music school, is that right? Music Academy in the US. Mm-hmm. Rohan Rhythm, it's called, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what are your students like, you know? Who is it? Do they come from local places or internationally, or how does it work?
Yeah. So again, you did a great job putting all these labels on me. So thank you for the master and the academy and studio. That's great. I do have some students. I've been lucky to have students both locally. I'm based in Oakland, California, just outside of San Francisco. And there's plenty of students that I've had in California, but plenty of students across the U.S. and actually here in Europe and of course, Ernst, you know, here in Munich, on Japan, India, Australia. So this all, of course, is all possible because of online music education, the Skype, the FaceTime, which is actually the topic of my PhD dissertation, online music education. And,
really?
Yeah. So specifically in the context of Indian percussion. So I was kind of looking at, you know, how the online education compares to face-to-face, and I studied, did research with students and teachers across the U.S., Europe, and India.
I see. So is this dissertation available online? So maybe I could put it in the show notes where we can find it?
Yeah, it's definitely available, and I'm happy to send you a copy of that too.
Cool.
So I have, you know, a lot of in-person and online students, and I kind of have, you know, I'm constantly thinking about, you know, how to teach and what my role is, you know. Most of the lessons tend to be private one-on-one lessons, so I'm very interested in sort of seeing where each student's coming from, what their goals are, and, you know, and how, you know, this art form and this creative process can enrich their lives. So for me, it's, the, you know, teaching percussion or teaching, you know, Indian rhythm and Indian music is actually, it's kind of towards a larger goal of being like a well-balanced, you know, and educated, you know, and cultured person. And being able to use, like, this creative process to tackle all sorts of non-musical things, too. For me, I think the repertoire and the techniques are actually just, they're kind of like a way into, like, this bigger world of thinking. So I connected with Ernst, I think, maybe, I don't know, maybe 4 years ago, something like that, or 5 years ago. And you know, he's, of course, a professional percussionist already, and he's been touring with Passport for years now. And he's, you know, I keep telling students, like, what I really love about, you know, Ernst is that he's a lifelong learner. You know, it's so easy to, you know, to plateau and say, okay, I got a certain career, you know, I got a family, I got, you know, some friends, like, let's just coast, keep going, keep doing this. But he's the kind of guy who's like, no, I saw something, you know, on YouTube or whatever, some concert, and it's really cool, it's really, really interesting, I want to learn more. Like, how can I enrich what I'm doing, you know, by learning more about this. And he just kind of jumped in head first. And so, yeah, he, you know, and then he connected with me, you know, through an online music education portal, and studied with me for, you know, for a few years. And we still, you know, keep talking about music all the time. And now he's kind of, he's been working on incorporating some of these Indian rhythmic ideas to kind of a modern jazz, you know, electroacoustic context with, you know, with this trio. And, you know, it's just, yeah, it's an ongoing story.
Great. So, summarize it, it's like hustle, 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 something like that, you know? So you're touring internationally, you're teaching online as well as face-to-face in your own academy. You are combining very innovative things like traditional Indian music with funk and jazz and fusion and something like that. And, you know, I read that you recently patented a really new invention for tuning a drum, you know? So how do we have to imagine, I mean, at the same time, you seem to be very relaxed. And I mean, I can see you, the listeners can just hear you, but I'm sure one can hear it. It sounds very, you know, so patient and so nice. And so how do you get all this stuff done in a 24-hour day in a 7 days week?
I don't. I wish I did, but I don't. I don't think you can do everything every day, okay? Like if I came up with a perfect schedule, you know, 23 minutes, I'm gonna do this, you know, 36 minutes, I'm gonna do this. Like, yeah, in theory you could do that, but it doesn't happen. I think you have to be open and flexible and look at kind of like a slightly larger, you know, scale, like maybe not day to day, but like week to week, you know? You can't, you know, do everything every single day in a perfectly balanced way. That's not human. And you may not feel it. Even if you have the time, you may not have the energy to do it. Or other days, like you have the energy and you really want to, you know, practice, you know, your Indian percussion on the mridangam or something, and you get into that. So you can't say, oh, I have 23 minutes to do that today. I'm not going to do 24. You know, if you're in that mindset, you know, we're human, like you have to do it, and, you know, and if you don't do it, then you lose it, you lose that energy. So, I mean, it's, again, I think you kind of have to be, you know, you got to work hard, but you also can't expect to be perfect. We're not machines, right? So we can't do everything every day.
And so there's something like a map, you know, okay, these are the things that have to be done, and it depends day by day, you know, which thing you're going into or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And what inspires you at that time. And, you know, it's I try my best not to go in with this, like, you know, again, here's like my exact schedule. Like, things happen. You get inspired, you know, and uninspired by different things, right? Suddenly you get a phone call from whatever, from a friend, and suddenly that conversation inspires you, you know, or you're doing something else. You think, okay, whatever, I got 23 minutes to do my, you know, household chores. And while you're doing that, suddenly you get some creative ideas, and then you got to turn to that, you know, or the other way around. You're practicing and, you know, whatever, you got to, you know, go walk the dog or something. So, yeah. You know, life happens. And so I think it's about the long haul, realizing that being a great, you know, artist, you know, is not about achieving X, Y, and Z, like within the next day or 2 days. Like,
it's like being more open-minded and see what comes the way along the way, something like this.
And working hard, but also giving yourself goals. It's not like totally free, like, you know, let's just see what happens. And, you know, you do have to be, you have to be very disciplined. The more you do, the more disciplined you have to be.
Yeah.
That's the reality. If I only did one thing, if I just, you know, whatever, you know, just taught, you know, the drum set every day, day in and day out, nothing else. Like, yeah, you can completely focus on that. But again, as human beings, like, we're usually interested in different things, and, you know, and there are different things we have to do. A lot of the stuff you mentioned that I'm doing is like, it's not like, again, it's not like I was 8 years old and said, okay, here's like 10 things I'm going to do in the next, you know, 20 years. It's like, you're responding to life. It's like, hey, I have this drum, this incredible instrument, the mridangam, that's like, you know, it's fun to play and I'm playing all these places. But it's really hard to tune. And it's really hard to change these heads with this traditional design. Like, impossible. You know, I got to do something about that. So then you start tinkering. It's okay, let me come up with, you know, another way of tuning this. And so it kind of develops, you know, in those ways. And so same thing, you know, you meet people. It's like, you know, I didn't just decide one day, okay, I got to create this hybrid kit to combine, you know, Indian drums and drum sets. Like, it's like, no, it's all these different things happened over the years. And then, sure, I would have loved to do this 20 years ago. I could, at the age of 8, if I knew what I knew now, like, sure, I could have done it then. But you don't know it then. You only know what you know now. And, you know, and then you have a, maybe a certain window of time. It's like, okay, in the last, you know, few years, I've been really focusing on developing this because I had the opportunity, I had the right teachers. You know, I was lucky to have, you know, Alan Hall at the California Jazz Conservatory as a drum guru, really, who, you know, helped me develop this. And, you know, and I've got some, you know, mentorship, you know, from other fantastic artists. So, you know, it all happened at a certain time, you know.
So that's maybe a nice message to the listeners out there, just not to be or to be a bit like patient, you know.
Yeah.
Keep on working, but things won't happen today and tomorrow. Maybe some things are evolving over the years and coming. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and just I think having that like mindset that, you know, for the long haul, you know, you got to be disciplined, you got to work hard, but you got to be patient, you know, and you have to be open and open-minded and creative at every stage, you know, as much as you can. Knowing, again, I'm not trying to make everything seem perfect here. It's like, no, there will be days where, like, you have, all, you know, you think all these things are going to happen and none of it happens.
Yeah.
You know, you have those rainy days all the time. Like, you know, I could have come here thinking, wow, it's going to be a perfect sunny day here in Dinkelsbühl and going to have this incredible, you know, lunch outside and this, you know, sun, but yeah, that's not
raining.
What we had today,
it's a rainy
right?
day today.
That's not what we had today.
But the lunch was great.
The lunch
also,
was good.
You know?
The lunch was good.
So hands on some practical things because, you know, every musician, is it even if it's a classical or a pop rock musician, one time, sooner or later in his career, is thinking about the field of Indian traditional music, because often it's like, you know, even the teacher says it or a colleague says it, that maybe you can expand something on your rhythmic vocabulary when you try something like a Konakol rhythm language or something. Mm. But, you know, talking about this in a general way is always easy. But the thing is, most people would not know where to start because it seems like, you know, a huge book and you don't know which page to read first.
Right.
Maybe you could, I mean, that's a hard task, but maybe you can give some advice and maybe one very basic practice possibility to get one first step in the field of this practice.
Oh, like you mean like a little musical?
Yeah, something
exercise,
like, you know, what one can maybe do during now, maybe driving in the car and listening to this podcast or
oh,
something.
Oh, well that, okay, that's
first step into maybe, Indian rhythm music.
Okay, well maybe yeah, maybe they should, you know, try this once they, you know, park and
yeah, stop the car right now, please. Yeah.
Don't drive and
don't come back to the podcast if something happens right now.
Don't
accident.
Yeah,
or
don't like recite Konakol and drive.
Try this at home.
But no, actually a really, really simple exercise that I like to do you know, in workshops is it's this idea that you're clapping a 3-beat cycle. So you're clapping it, the way you do it's like a clap, clap, wave. 1, 2, 3. So clap, clap, wave. So you're doing this, and then you're saying a very simple rhythm. It's just a 3-note rhythm. And then you do it in like a second speed and a third speed, meaning you say it twice as fast and then 4 times as fast. And then keep the clapping steady. So it goes like this. And ta, ki, ta, 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 ta, ki, ta,
So thank you very much.
Yeah,
that was it for the first maybe step into the Indian rhythm language. Thank you very much for your time. I mean, it's very late now. It's after the show and it's almost, you know, everybody is waiting for you to come to the after show party or something like this. And you're right. Coming with me to have a talk. It's very great. You know?
But I mean, thanks a lot, Max. I think I'm happy that you are doing this podcast and tackling some really serious issues. A lot of times we don't, you know, necessarily learn these things in school. You know, what do you do as a freelancer, as a musician? You know, what's the next step? I mean, oftentimes I think, you know, we have a lot of these questions as students at a conservatory. So it's nice to kind of hear, you know, different people's stories and how that, you know, we all kind of navigate, you know, these twists and turns in different ways. And you know, thanks for providing that kind of knowledge to the community.
Thank you very much. We're finishing every podcast with four very quick questions.
Uh-oh.
No worries. Question number one. Is there something that you are learning or practicing at the moment? What are you practicing at the moment?
Actually, in terms of Indian percussion, I've been spending a lot of time working on what you could probably call the rudiments, the basic stroke sequences, basic hand movements. That kind of form the basis of all of these fast, intricate patterns. So,
back to the roots, something like
back,
this.
Yeah, back, you know, back to the basics. The more and more I play, the more, you know, I see the value of the basics, you know, really focusing on those basic movements.
Great. Second question. Which book or what do you read maybe at the moment?
Well, I mean, honestly, I'm just trying to keep up with the news. So it's been busy, you know, it's been very busy and it's been honestly just a struggle to keep up with the news, which, by the way, you know, I've heard a lot of people say, you know, the news is depressing and, you know, you don't want to read it. But I still see a value in kind of, you know, reading the news and seeing what's going on, you know, in different aspects of, you know, of our society and our world.
Important.
So yeah. I think it's important to be as aware, you know, as we can, especially about stuff that we don't necessarily know about and maybe don't even care about. You know, I think that's part of reading the news.
Absolutely. The podcast is online on iTunes and also on Spotify. Mm-hmm. And I was creating a Spotify playlist. And every guest is free to have a wish of one song that will be added to the playlist after the talk has been streamed.
Hmm.
What could be your song for the list?
Oh, well, it's going to have to be some kind of Indian percussion solo. I'm not sure what's on Spotify, but there might be something from an artist by the name of Palghat Mani Iyer. So Palghat Mani Iyer is like one of the legends of Indian percussion in the Mridangam of the 20th century. So that might be something really cool for, you know, your listeners to hear, and just to hear, you know, a master at work on that instrument. So I'll help you find some recording of his.
Great, perfect. Last question. After, you know, one of your long days, whatever you have been done on this day, you know, maybe one of the rainy days and maybe very lots of appointments and teaching and stuff like that, is there anything, you know, any ritual or something you come home and you have to do to get out of your work feeling, your head, you know, clearing your head and coming home and, I don't know, sit on the couch and have the possibility to relax and maybe to pause your thoughts for a moment or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of things. After a long day and even after a not so long day, I like to cook. Cooking's something I find really relaxing and fun and creative. And it's one of those things you know, there's also that kind of instant gratification. You make something and you can actually eat it. You know, it's
absolutely not something. Finally,
something, you know, tangible, you know, it's, you know, that you can see and feel and, you know, smell and taste.
Great.
I also like to run. So even not after necessarily a long day, but at the beginning of a long day, I think going for a run in that kind of, going, especially outdoors, and especially in a new place, I think really just kind of opens up the mind and body. So, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. So now let's maybe run down to the after show party. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks a lot, Max.
Bye.
Take care.
Ja, das war's schon wieder. Wir sind am Ende der aktuellen Folge angekommen. Ich packe euch auf jeden Fall die Dissertation von Rohan und ein paar Links zu seinen aktuellen Projekten in die Shownotes und hoffe, dass wir uns dann hier in 2 Wochen zur gewohnten Zeit wieder treffen. Weil ich erst relativ spät damit begonnen habe, den Podcast in diesem Jahr auszustrahlen, habe ich übrigens beschlossen, ohne Sommerpause bis zum Ende der ersten Staffel weiterzumachen, sodass ihr also auch im Sommerurlaub weiterhin mit interessanten Talks versorgt werdet. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Ciao.